From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM, and it's going to be one of those nights. So shut off the television, dim the lights, turn up the radio, and get ready for Coast to Coast AM. Later on tonight, those open lines. Here is what's happening. Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff has called on the entire country of Brazil to help combat the spread of the Zika virus, which has now been linked to birth defects. She says the national mobilization was needed to eliminate the mosquitoes that spread the virus and urge community groups and unions to help out. Zika is thought to cause a form of infant brain damage. 3 to 4 million people could be infected with Zika in the Americas this year. In the United States, we already have a few cases. And British couples should not try to have a baby for a month if a partner has just returned from one of the 23 countries affected by this virus, according to public health officials there. Geez. And at least 179 students and staff members at a Southeast Texas middle school receive hospital treatment after an apparent carbon monoxide leak. The Beaumont emergency personnel said the children and adults from the middle school were being treated for non-life-threatening injuries. Carbon monoxide is odorless. You just can't smell it. You don't know what's happening until you pass out. Finland is now the latest country to announce plans to boot out migrants, with plans to send 20,000 people packing. The Finnish government is set to deport two-thirds of the 32,000 asylum seekers it received last year whose applications have been turned down. The announcement comes after Sweden said it would send 80,000 asylum seekers back to their home countries on chartered flights. ISIS chiefs are living in fear of a mystery sniper after it was rumored that three of the terror group's leaders have been assassinated within 10 days of each other by a long-range marksman from somewhere. And an air mechanic whose cousin joined the Islamic State terrorist group in Syria is suspected of being the one that planted a bomb on a Russian passenger plane that exploded over Egypt's skies in October. Remember that one? Killing all 224 people on board. Dr. Jerome Corsi, who writes for WND, a noted author, he is with us. Jerry, it's good that ISIS is scared of a sniper, isn't it?
Well, I think it's probably a good idea, George, yes, but you know, this kind of mystery sniper, it may be just an urban myth. It may just be the violence killing some of the ISIL or ISIS leaders in Libya. It's funny because in the this Arab world, it's being identified with the movie Enemy at the Gates. And you remember the sniper that was played by Judd Law.
Mm-hmm.
You know, from Moscow and that fighting and Stalingrad. Well, that kind of a mythical figure has taken hold in the Middle East. And, you know, they're calling snipers Sniper Moscow in his honor. So there are snipers operating in the Middle East and often claim to be U.S. commandos undercover, or just perhaps maybe at this town that the killings are occurring in, three sniper shots killing three ISIS leaders in the town where Gaddafi was born. This could be a sniper from Misrata, which is a town nearby, and militia from Misrata were very involved in the uprising that led to the fall of Gaddafi. So there's a lot of possibilities, but there certainly has taken hold in the Middle East this idea of mystery snipers killing ISIS commanders.
And Jerry, a good sniper can pluck somebody out from thousands of feet away, can he?
Well, that's right. And good snipers are going to operate so that they're completely undetected. You won't know which direction the shot came from. It will be impossible to find out where the sniper was. That's the whole point of professional sniping, is that someone is killed and you have no way of really knowing where the shot came from or who took the shot. But a good sniper can kill from hundreds of yards away and be very effective and do so from an undercover concealed position. That's the whole point of being an effective sniper.
Sure can. Jerry, you take care. Have a good weekend, okay?
Thanks, George. You too, and also for the listeners. Thank you.
Dr. Jerry Corsi. A satanic group is set to deliver an opening prayer at an upcoming meeting of the Phoenix City Council, sparking controversy there. The local satanic temple will deliver the invocation on the council's February 17th meeting after winning approval. Unbelievable. Well, you know, Zechariah Sitchin, when he wrote the book in his series of the Earth Chronicles, talked about a collision that Earth had with another planet. How would he know that? Other than he said, of course, he got the information from ancient Sumerian writings and cuneiforms. Well, the early Earth apparently was mixed with a baby planet called Theia following a head-on collision 4.5 billion years ago. Scientists have just discovered this. Earth is actually made up of two planets that came together in a head-on collision that was so violent it formed the moon. Yet Zechariah Sitchin knew way before these scientists. It's amazing. What else is out there? Let's check in with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Hey, Peter.
Well, good evening, George. I'm delighted to be able to report that the hotline's been relatively quiet over the last week, but the flow of written reports hasn't diminished a bit, so I'm delighted that people are finally going directly to the report form and submitting written reports rather than having to talk about them first. That's a big help to me. A lot of crazy things going on, and first couple of reports of five have to do with the sonic booms that occurred on the East Coast last night. I think you reported them in the news segment. We received a very interesting analysis from a gentleman who sounds like he has some pretty good technical know-how. He has looked at the data and has determined that the width of the shockwave as it passed along the Earth, along the East coast, I think going north, but I may be mistaken, happened at 1:23:45 hours yesterday afternoon, East Coast time, 140 miles wide, and he's done a calculation and pointed out that that requires an object that was at 140,000 feet above the surface of the planet. There's a relationship between the width of the shockwave and the height of the object that's causing it. So it suggests to him, and I was a little suspicious of those reports yesterday too, a sonic boom that causes the ground to shake, according to witnesses, is something unusual. I grew up in St. Louis, almost raised by shock waves.
Yes, you did.
From those supersonic planes out of St. Louis. It was almost a badge of courage to hear one. But this gentleman's analysis is on our homepage, and I invite people to read it, and if they have any comments, I'd welcome them. The interesting thing is about 36 minutes later, following those shock waves, a woman in Knoxville, Tennessee, reports having seen something very interesting. She said it was a triangular-shaped object with a chrome ventral surface, very dark dorsal surface. The top of it was dark. Had a spine running down the middle of it like a cockpit, she says. It was moving across her house and her community so fast that it scared her. She says she's a very experienced sky watcher. She's seen the Space Shuttle, Air Force One, meteors, and so on and so forth. She said she's never seen anything like it. It really upset her, and that report is posted to our website. Whether it was related to the shock waves on the East Coast or not, I guess all we can do is flip a coin, George.
All right, my friend.
A few hours later, Waukesha, Wisconsin, which is a little ways west of Milwaukee, right on Interstate 94 that connects Milwaukee and Madison, I believe. A gentleman was driving south on Highway 74. He looks off to his quartering left. He sees what he thinks is a firework at first, but it's hovering above a tree. Suddenly, he writes in his report that is posted to our website, it suddenly accelerated like a bottle rocket. He said he's never seen anything move so fast, went straight up in the sky and disappeared from his sight. Less than 2 hours later, an adult woman, her adult daughter, were standing outside in Amsterdam, New York, and the mother saw a very peculiar light moving erratically across the sky. It stopped behind a row of trees near their home. She summoned her daughter, and they both stood there and looked at it. Suddenly it accelerated and went the opposite direction from which it had been going. And as it went over their heads, they heard a humming, peculiar humming sound from it. And last report comes from Indio, California, out east of Los Angeles, of course. A gentleman was sitting at his desk at 11:20 this morning. He heard what he thought was the crack of a whip. Very strange sound, he says. He looked out his window and saw a triangular craft streaking across the daytime sky, right behind it, two F-16s, either in pursuit or chaperoning it. We'd have to talk to the pilots, and that's probably not very likely to determine what they were doing there. But suddenly the black object in the lead did a sudden flip turn to the right. It left the F-16s in its wake. Reminds me much of the Stevensville case, Stevensville, Texas, back, almost years ago now. So sure, lots of things going on, and four of those five reports are posted to the website ufocenter.com.
Super. Peter, thank you so much. In Maine, a heartless person who ditched a dog that was hit and killed by a car may face criminal charges. God, who would do that? As the story spread across social media, Lewiston police said on Facebook that the person had been identified and interviewed, and they will forward this to the district attorney's office for review and the filing of a formal criminal charge is likely. The dog was a yellow lab mix, was killed 3 days after being abandoned in the parking lot of an animal shelter in Lewiston that was closed at the time. Surveillance video shows that the dog being let out of a minivan and then chasing the vehicle as it drives off. And several days later, he got hit by a car and died. In a moment, we're going to talk about some very strange things. First of all, amazing dogs. A terrier that apparently spent 14 years guarding his master's grave. What a story. And also buried alive. Just think about that. You're not dead. You wake up and you're in the casket, 6 feet under. I can't think of anything worse. In a moment, John Bondichon joins us as we talk about these on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie. John Bondichon, of course, was with us years ago. He's back. He's an associate professor at Cardiff University in Wales, author of the best-selling book Buried Alive, about the history of the signs of death and the risk of being buried alive by mistake. That used to happen a lot in the old days. He's a biographer of a predecessor of Jack the Ripper, the London monster who stabbed 50 women in their rear end, of all places. How about Edward the Boy Jones, who stalked Queen Victoria, stole some of her undergarments? And then the Grey Friars Bobby, a Scottish terrier that spent apparently 14 years guarding his master's grave. In that book, Amazing Dogs, here's John to talk about all of these. John, welcome back to Coast. It's been a long time.
It's been a long time indeed, yes.
Looking forward to this. Let's start by talking about Amazing Dogs because of that story I had before the break, of course, of someone who dumped a dog at a shelter, took off, and the poor dog got hit by a car a couple days later. I can't believe that. But you've got some amazing dog stories in this book. How did you find them?
Well, I did a lot of research both in London and in various German and French archives and libraries. And, of course, I went to Edinburgh to investigate the case of little Grey Friars Bobby, that terrier that was said to have kept vigil on his master's grave for 14 years.
That is something. Did he literally stayed at the grave?
Well, he definitely existed. That's the nicest thing you can say about him. From about 1860 until his death in 1872. There definitely was a cemetery dog at the Grey Friars Cemetery in Edinburgh, and He didn't keep vigil at any grave, though. He went about as he wanted, really. Went to see his various friends in the neighborhood, and every day there was a time gun in Edinburgh, the 1 o'clock gun. And when Bobby heard the gun banging away, he went down to a restaurant nearby where they had a meal ready for him.
Oh, the animals are smart. They really are, aren't they, John?
Yes, they certainly are, but there's nothing that's very edifying in the story of Greyfriars Bobby, though, because already during his lifetime there were objections whether he really was keeping vigil on his master's grave, and there's also been a debate ever since whether his master was a shepherd or perhaps a policeman. And if you look at the various drawings of the dog, it's clear that there were, in fact, two Bobbies. One of them became famous in 1867, then he died, and to keep the story alive, they got hold of another Bobby who resided in the cemetery from 1867 until 1872. So the myth of the cemetery dog that keeps vigil on his master's grave is really a story that's been going on all over Europe. It's known since classical antiquity, and every one of the great cemeteries in Paris had a cemetery dog that was supposed to be mourning his master.
I'm sure everybody who has owned a dog can attest to some kind of intelligence there, something special that the animal has done. You've looked at a lot of different cases in your book, Amazing Dogs. What? Tell me about Don the Talking Dog.
Well, Don the Talking Dog was probably the most famous talking dog ever. He lived in the years just before the First World War, and he knew 9 words which he was said to be using intelligently. For example, if his master asked him, "Don, should we go for a walk?" then the dog said, "Ja." He spoke only German, meaning yes.
Now, did he bark it or speak it?
He spoke it. Some dogs are very clever when it comes to imitating the human voice. And he was a great success in the Berlin music halls. And he came to New York City in 1912. And then when he crossed the Atlantic, he was insured for $50,000, making him the most valuable dog in the world.
Now, that's a lot of money in those days, too. That would probably be equate to us to millions right about now, wouldn't it?
It certainly would, yes.
The Nazis were very interested in super intelligent dogs as well, weren't they?
They were indeed. And in Germany at that time, from the First World War to the interwar years, there was a movement called New Animal Psychology, which argued that horses and dogs were as intelligent as human beings if they were given the opportunity to study. And the most famous super intelligent dog was Rolf, a native of Mannheim. And he tapped out messages by striking his paw against a board. For example, when he was asked what he liked most, he said, "Eat salmon." And then what he liked most, apart from that, was reading illustrated books, because he could read as well. And when the First World War broke out, Rolf wanted to join the army, because he felt very aggrieved that the French had invaded holy German soil. And upon the fall of Antwerp, he barked, and the children in the household where he lived, they sang "Deutschland, Deutschland über alles," and Rolf followed them barking and growling. And then he ran up to his mistress, and he started tapping his paw against the board, and he said, "And now we take Paris."
Jeez.
So he was quite a military strategist, that dog. But as the war went on and Germany suffered some crushing defeats, he changed his mind and wanted to become a rescue dog instead. And in the end, he became a pacifist.
He saw the light.
And a feminist as well, saying that if women had ruled the world, then the world war would have been avoided.
Well, you might be right about that. John, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back and talk about your other work called Buried Alive, This is the spooky one, everyone. So we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. John's books and websites all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. And welcome back to Coast, John Bondeschan with us. We're talking now about his work, Buried Alive. And John, before we get going, do you know our friend Lionel Fanthorpe, who also is a professor part-time at Cardiff?
Well, I don't know anything about him being in Cardiff, but I have met him quite a few times. He's a clergyman, isn't he?
Yeah, he is.
Very interested in various forties.
Anglican priest.
A lot of books.
He sure has. He's one of a kind. He's got one of those deep voices, and he's one of a kind. But let's get into Buried Alive. Let's first of all, how in the world did you pick up a topic like that?
Well, I had a chapter about it in my early book, Cabinet of Medical Curiosities. And then I did a TV documentary on the subject in 1999. And W.W. Norton publishers got interested and they commissioned a book on the subject. And I spent a whole year traveling in France and Germany. And I got a grant from the Wellcome Foundation in London to finish the book off. And it was published back in 2001.
Okay, now. This fear, this horrible fear of people, I'm not sure everybody wakes up thinking, I'm going to be buried alive. But it is kind of uncanny to think about when you get into it, isn't it?
It is indeed. And people have been concerned about the risk of being buried alive since the 1700s. And there are people making precautions in their wills that their throat should be cut after death, or their arteries should be cut, or their head should be cut off. And it correlates with the increasing use of coffins, because then the body, of course, had a closed room after death, and the people became worried. Were they really dead? They didn't trust the doctors. And in the 1740s, there were two French physicians named Winslow and Bruyer who wrote an alarmist book saying that the signs of death, like the feeling for the pulse or putting a mirror to the mouth to see if there was any breathing, they were all completely unreliable. So the only certain sign of death was putrefaction. And although some other doctors objected, Bruyer and Winslow won the day. And in Germany in particular, there was much agitation about the risk of being buried alive. And they built waiting mortuaries like hospitals for the dead so they could incubate the corpses until they were putrid.
Now, how did they know that some people were being buried alive?
Well, the fear of being buried alive was greatly overrated, and it never happened that any person woke up in these hospitals for the dead they had in Germany. And those hospitals were not small. There was one in Munich that looked almost like the White House in Washington, an enormous building. And there was another one in Vienna with an electrical signaling system so that if any corpse moved, a bell would ring and an assistant would come to the rescue. And I visited Vienna recently, and they actually had a signaling machine there, the only one in the world, I believe it is, on exhibition. And there were also security coffins invented to prevent people from being buried alive. And Duke Ferdinand of Brunswick, he had a coffin built with a lock on the inside, and he was buried in a vault, of course, so that they had a pocket in the shroud with a key to the vault. And then if he was buried alive, he could just unlock the coffin and the vault and walk out. And there were various ideas how to prevent people from being buried alive, more or less realistic, like having every person who should be buried should have a trumpet with them in the coffin so they could sound a deathly fanfare 6 feet under if they were still alive, or they should have an axe and a spade with them in the coffin so they could tunnel their way up to rejoin the remainder of humanity. And both in Europe and in the United States, there was much activity inventing security coffins with signaling systems, like if the corpse moved, then a bell would ring or a flag would wave above ground. But they were never realistic because the systems were too sensitive. And during the putrefactive changes, they would be set off and people would have to dig up putrefying corpses all the time. So even though there were at least 22 patent coffins of that kind in the United States from 1865 until 1925, none of them really caught on.
Now, in the old days, and you mentioned bells that they used to use, I mean, did they actually have, like, string into the coffin? Maybe they tied it around the dead person's finger, and then they had a little bell standing outside of it?
Well, the system I saw in Vienna, that was a fairly simple one. It was from the 1820s, and it was called a Rettungswecker, so a signaling machine to save the apparently dead. So it had a string tied to the wrist of the dead person, so that if the hand moved, a bell would ring, and then the attendant of the mortuary would come to the rescue. And there have been cases of people really being buried alive. I mean, the sheer number of people dying and the carelessness of the doctors, and in cholera, in the cold stage of the cholera, a person can become very death-like and still be able to recover. In 1822, a shoemaker in Stuttgart was buried alive. He knocked on the coffin lid as they were putting earth down onto the coffin, and they took him out of the coffin, and he was alive. Jeez. And in 1867, a 24-year-old woman was buried alive in France, and she also knocked on the coffin lid during the burial, and after that she was seen to move her eyelids, and she had a heartbeat, and she breathed.
Now, here's a frightening thought too, John. What if when you die, you're still connected to the body somehow? And so if they bury you in a coffin, you're still alert, can't move, can't do anything, but for some reason your subconscious is still alive, and you're like entombed in there forever.
Yes, that was something they called the Scheintod in German, and a state of death-like trance. And such a condition really existed at the time, particularly in women. It was a pseudo-hysterical conversion system that they had in that existed in those days. It doesn't exist nowadays. So people could become extremely death-like and still be capable of life.
Okay, so with these bells, I'm fascinated by this, that they had there. What if the wind sometimes would, like, blow it? Would they dig up the coffin?
Well,
thinking somebody's alive?
The most intricate German security coffins actually had a housing around the bell to prevent that from happening.
Ah,
they were very
thought of everything.
And they even had a meshwork around the breathing apparatus so that insects wouldn't crawl down into the coffin and annoy the prematurely buried person. But the problem with all of these signaling systems was that they were too sensitive. They wanted to make sure that even the most enfeebled wretch down there in the coffin would be able to set the bell ringing. And as a consequence, the system was set off during putrefaction down in the coffin. So that was a problem with all of these security coffin systems, of which there were many in the United States.
All right, here's my story joke about being buried alive. There was a guy who was sickly, and he told his family, he said, "Look, I'm petrified of being buried alive." And they went, "Oh, Dad, don't worry." He said, "No, I really am." And he said, if I die, I want you to bury me with a cell phone. And they went, sure, Dad, whatever you want. Well, he died. And so they're burying him. And one of the daughters said, remember the promise we made to Dad? We had to put a cell phone in there. And the son said, oh, come on, that's a waste. Then he said, we made a promise to Dad. So they dropped the cell phone in the coffin. They buried him, and that was it. He's not dead, John. He wakes up. And the first thing he thinks of was, oh, I hope they put a cell phone in here. So he's feeling around, right? It's black. It's all dark in there. He feels the cell phone, opens it up, turns it on. It's pitch black. And a light across the top says, no service. That's my joke. Did you get it?
Yes, by all means.
And where's that British sense of humor?
Well into modern times that the people have taken overdoses of barbiturates in freezing cold weather, and then they become very death-like. There was a German nurse in 1919. There was a Frenchman in 1937. And in the 1970s, a young French drug addict in Britain took an overdose, and he woke up when they were screwing down his coffin. So people are really at risk of being buried alive even today, and the best safeguard is really not to take a drug overdose, because then you can be diagnosed dead by mistake. And when I did interviews on the radio after the publication of Buried Alive, there had just been a woman waking up in a morgue in New York State. And when I did another radio show in one of the southern states, there was a man ringing in saying that his grandfather had been a gravedigger in a local churchyard, but he couldn't stand the job because he had to work with the exhumation of coffins for a restructuring of the burial ground. And he had a horrible experience to see how many of the corpses had been buried alive by mistake. So they were gashed and broken foreheads from pounding coffin lids,
screaming,
torn fingernails, desperately contorted faces, and the worst of all were the prematurely buried women who had pulled out their beautiful long hair, which was found wound around their decomposing fingers or clutched in their skeleton hands. So that was quite a horrible story.
Well, and if you're buried 6 feet under, the weight of the dirt is going to prevent you from lifting the coffin lid anyway, isn't it?
It is indeed, and it's quite a desperate situation. And there are various stories in the literature. For example, several French authors at the time, including Emile Zola, write about premature burial victims who have a fortunate escape, but that's quite unrealistic. If you are buried alive, it's quite a desperate situation. You simply can't save yourself unless you have a cell phone with you. And Edgar Allan Poe was, of course, quite obsessed with the theme of apparent death and premature burial, which occurs in quite a few of his stories. But just like a modern author using AIDS and HIV as one of his metaphors, he was simply reacting to the medical reality of his time. He was not by no means the only person in America being fearful of being buried alive.
Well, with John Bondeshaan, we're talking about his book, Buried Alive. Do you believe today some people are actually buried alive?
I certainly do, because the methods used for declaring people dead in third world countries are quite similar to those used in Europe in the 19th century. So people are still at risk of being buried alive in developing countries, and there have been near misses reported both in Europe and in the United States, like careless doctors or careless coroners declaring people dead after a fit or a diabetic coma. And then they're in the ambulance on the way to the morgue or at the morgue itself, they are found to be still alive. And there are so many of those that surely one or two will actually be buried alive by mistake.
Let's take just a few minutes before the break, then we'll take phone calls next hour. The London Monster, who stalked Queen Victoria, and he did some very strange, bizarre things, didn't he?
He did indeed, and between 1788 and 1790, 50 London women were attacked. They were stabbed in the buttocks or kicked with a spike or stabbed in the nose with a sharp needle hidden in a bouquet of flowers.
Did he try to kill them, John?
What's that?
Did he try to kill them or just...
No, he didn't. He was a sadist. He wasn't a killer. He did it for kicks. And there was a mass hysteria in London. There was a reward of £100 for the capture of the London Monster. But nobody was ever killed. But wealthy ladies took precautions. They had cork rumps made or reinforced petticoats to be safe from the monster's knife. And in the end, they arrested a Welsh artificial flower maker in June 1790. His name was Rinnick Williams, and he was a well-known street pest who was chasing women about and asking them to sleep with him. And there was a series of police lineups so the monster's victims could see Williams and identify him as the monster. And after two ludicrous trials, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison, and the monster attacks ceased at that time. Although the jury is still out whether he was really the guilty man.
Did you ever investigate the actual Jack the Ripper story?
Yes, I have. I have had a book published about an old novel from 1905 about Jack the Ripper by a man named Guy Logan, who was a journalist active at the time, and that novel contains. Some facts about the Ripper that Logan dug out, and some people seem to think that it solves the entire case, although I'm quite a doubter in that respect. It is rather a good novel, and I wrote an introduction with a biography of Logan and also a postscript about the various theories of Jack the Ripper.
Well, you're a pretty prolific writer, John, and great stories indeed. Now, of all of them that you write, the stories about amazing dogs, buried alive, is there that one story that fascinates you the most?
Well, the stories of the Nazis and the super intelligent dogs is quite a good one. Because after this, famous dog, Rolf, who could tap out messages and write poetry, and discussed the war. He had a daughter named Lola, and she was also a super intelligent dog, and there were quite a few of them in Germany. And the Nazis did take an interest in these super intelligent dogs because they thought if they were the Herrenfolk and superior to all the other peoples of Europe, then surely German dogs should also be superior to foreign ones. So the good Nazi was a friend of dogs and a friend of animals. And there was a little dachshund they had in the 1930s called Kurvenal, who could bark out messages with a certain number of barks signifying each letter in the alphabet. And he was quite a favorite with the German Tierschutz, the Animal Protection League. So on Kurvenal's birthday, he was visited by 27 uniformed youngsters from the Hitlerjugend. And the Tierschutzführer started reading a poem to the dog. But after 18 verses, the dog started barking. And then they said, "What is he saying? Please, no more poetry."
I love it. Unbelievable. They're almost like parrots, aren't they?
Rather, yes. And in Germany, there were also various schools and institutes for communication between humans and dogs, so the Tiersprachschule. And there was a scientist named Werner Fischel who was supplied with the dogs for his experiments by the office of the Reichsführer SS Heinrich Himmler.
Amazing science. Hey, John, we're going to take this quick break. We're going to come right back with you. We're going to take phone calls, questions, and stories next.